It's 6:20. This is KERA News. I'm Justin Martin. The mayors of Dallas and Fort Worth dropped into Austin today to meet with the governor. Greg Abbott has been sitting down with mayors from across Texas as the legislature works through his special session agenda. A primary point of contention, bills that the mayors say limit local control. Those range from smaller issues like tree rules and texting bans to big things like making it harder to raise the property taxes that fund local governments and schools. KERA's Christopher Connolly caught up with Fort Worth Mayor Betsy Price during her drive back to Fort Worth. She said cities have had to raise property taxes to make up for state spending cuts.
We wanted to reiterate again that the only real property tax relief is going to be if they tackle school funding and that we're not out of control on our spending.
Price called the 45-minute conversation wide-ranging and positive. She and Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings asked the governor about SB 4, that's the new state law that will penalize local officials who do not fully cooperate with federal immigration authorities. Critics have focused on how the legislation authorizes local law enforcement officers to ask about citizenship status for people they've detained or arrested.
It's a bill that really is aimed at picking up criminals. It's not necessarily saying you have to ask everybody for papers. It's not a papers bill, and it was good to hear him reiterate that.
Price has had some problems with the law, and she said only the federal government can actually solve immigration issues. The Fort Worth City Council got a briefing on the local impact of the law from an assistant city attorney and police officials this afternoon. And tonight, activists are planning to formally ask the council to join a lawsuit challenging the measure's constitutionality. Christopher Connolly will report on that meeting and the protests planned outside it tomorrow on Morning Edition. One of the lightning rod issues of the current special session in Austin is the so-called bathroom bill, which would limit the public restroom options for transgender people. Today on Think, Chris Boyd talked with transgender author Heath Fogg Davis about another possibility, removing gender classifications from restrooms altogether.
I nowadays experience no harassment, no questions when I go to use a men's bathroom in the public sphere. All of my life, up until the time that I transitioned, I was pretty consistently harassed and yelled at, told that I was in the wrong place, questioned. I go over in one of the chapters a case where a masculine appearing woman was literally ejected from a toilet stall by a bouncer who came in and pounded on the door and told her to get out. Even when she showed him her state ID with a female marker, he wasn't interested and she was still ejected. So I think gender policing is the real issue here, and it's something that affects a whole range of people. So not just transgender people, you know, a lot of masculine appearing girls and women and feminine appearing boys and men are subject to this on a pretty constant basis.
Heath Fogg Davis wrote the book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? This episode of Think re-airs tonight at 10, and you can subscribe to the podcast at think.kera.org. Today is the first day of campus carry at Texas community colleges. The law allows licensed gun owners to carry a concealed handgun on campus, something that took effect at four-year schools a year ago. KERA's Stella Chavez caught up with several students today.
Hariz Mudani is a student at Brookhaven College in Farmers Branch. He says the new law wasn't even on his radar.
Well, it's clearly not the best idea, especially whenever you consider the epidemic of shootings across the country, not only on campuses, but within other public areas as well.
Student David Ferrer disagrees. He's a first-year mechanical engineering student at Brookhaven.
Personally, I like to have the chance to defend myself than just sit there and have something happen. It's hard to think about. Nobody wants to, but that's just what it is.
Ferrer says he debated the issue in his high school government class. The debate took place after a gunman shot and killed a student at Northlake College in Irving. Victoria Panchenko, a 30-year-old student who's studying graphic design, says Brookhaven started sending out emails about the new law at the end of last semester.
I understand the Second Amendment and the right of people, but it's a student campus, so I go mostly at night to classes, and it doesn't make me feel safe at all.
She says it's hard to know if someone carrying a weapon is doing it for self-defense reasons or to do harm. Stella Chavez, KERA News.
Now to our One Crisis Away project and a new study showing the harsh impact that growing up in a poor neighborhood has on a kid's development. Researchers in Texas, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin found the number of children living in high poverty neighborhoods surged during the Great Recession. KEI's Jeff Whittington talked with Rice University sociologist Rachel Kimbrough about why the kids living in those neighborhoods were already a year behind their peers before they even started school.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What makes a neighborhood a high poverty neighborhood?
We define a high poverty neighborhood as one where 40% or more of residents live below the poverty line.
And some of these neighborhoods were defined as mid-poverty and low poverty, but they're all poor neighborhoods.
Exactly. They're all the sort of environment where we might worry about where that kid is living.
Your study examined the years between 1998 and 2010. Why was that time period important?
Our study used two different cohorts of U.S. kindergartners, one who started kindergarten in 1998 and one who started in 2010. Because we had those two cohorts of kindergartners in that time period, it allowed us to look at children's living circumstances and school readiness both before and after the Great Recession.
Sort of a happy accident.
Exactly.
And you found that more children and their families were living in high poverty neighborhoods in 2010 than were in 1998, even kids whose families weren't necessarily poor themselves. How did that happen?
So we think that it really demonstrates the reach of the Great Recession. Families who normally would not live in high poverty neighborhoods either had to move into them because of foreclosure or job loss, or moderate or middle income neighborhoods became poor neighborhoods because many of the residents lost income.
What happens to a child's school readiness when they move into a poor neighborhood?
One of the reasons we were so concerned to see the increase in the number of children living in high poverty neighborhoods was because we found that they were a full year behind their peers when they started kindergarten.
Why do you think that is?
We know that there are resources in neighborhoods that are important for child development, and that could include things like churches or Head Start centers or libraries. And so when kids live in neighborhoods that don't have those kinds of resources, that can set them back academically.
How many more kids were living in high poverty neighborhoods at the end of the study in 2010 than in 1998?
If we look at it in terms of all kinds of poverty neighborhoods, we find that in 1998, 36% of children lived there, and it had risen to 43.9% by 2010.
So 3 out of every 10 kids was living in a poor neighborhood, and at the end of the study period, it was getting closer to 5 out of every 10 kids.
That's right.
And this is across the country?
This is nationwide.
How do these trends affect kids of color?
What we found was that the kids who had the highest gains in terms of living in high poverty neighborhoods were actually white children and children whose families were not poor. Now, it's important to remember, though, that minority children are much more likely to live in high poverty neighborhoods. It's just that the change during the recession happened to be bigger for white kids and for non-poor kids. High poverty neighborhoods shifted geographically in terms of where they are. So they were no longer concentrated just in urban areas. They spread out more into the South and into the Midwest, where the demographics are just different. So it really kind of spread out across the country.
Did your research uncover any potential solutions to this issue?
Right now, children are often targeted for intervention services after they arrive into the school system, so maybe pre-K or kindergarten. But they often are targeted based on family characteristics like income. And we argue that targeting entire neighborhoods has the potential to help a lot more children.
And what would those interventions look like?
One of the things that we suggest is that more Head Start centers are located and opened in high poverty neighborhoods to try and reach those children before they get into the school system.
Rachel Kimbrough is a sociology professor at Rice University's School of Social Sciences and founding director of the Kinder Institute's Urban Health Program. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thanks for having me.
It's 6:30. This is KERA News.